Okay, well, thank you all for sitting patiently, and good morning, everybody. For those of you who don't know me, my name's Jenny Lyon. I'm the Senior Vice President of the Actuaries Institute, and I'm delighted to welcome you all here to the 8th Enterprise Risk Management Seminar. I have to say I was surprised that we'd already got to 8. Firstly, I'd like to acknowledge and pay my respects to the traditional owners of the land on which we meet, the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation. So during the seminar today, the speakers are going to look at the broader risk environment, some of the important roles that risk managers perform, as well as including useful case studies and highlighting new ideas and approaches that can be applied to actuarial roles. On behalf of the Institute, I'd like to acknowledge and thank our sponsor, SKL, and our supporting partners, RMIA and ANZIF, for their support of the seminar. If you're using social media, we'd invite you to follow the seminar on Twitter and keep up to date with what's happening by using @ActuariesInstitute and #2016ERM. I'm sure you've all turned your mobile phones to silent already. If you haven't, please do. The bathrooms, if you need them, outside along on the left. And really, I just want to say, I think it looks like it's going to be a really interesting program, wide range of speakers, and I'd encourage you all to take advantage of their experience and knowledge and give them some pretty challenging questions and comments. And finally, I'd just like to introduce Brett Riley, who's the convener of the RMPC and a member of the organising committee. And so he's going to introduce and give some opening remarks. I hope you have a great day. Thank you.
Thanks, Jenny. Thank you all. Good morning. On behalf of the organising committee, I'd like to welcome both Institute members and our guests, our non-members. I'll make my introduction brief because I think everyone's probably chomping at the bit to hear our keynote speaker. The theme for the day is practical risk management, so it's meant to be a formula-free zone. I haven't checked all the slides to see if any slipped through, but it is meant to be very practical, focused on current challenges facing people who work in or around risk management. So risk managers, CROs, there'll be some actuaries among you working in more traditional roles, some non-executive directors, but a broad range of people who will, I think, take something from today. We have 14 speakers from a diverse range of backgrounds and experience, so please focus on what they have to say, because I'm sure there'll be something or a few things for you to take away. The topics we're covering today will be relevant to most businesses, but I think they'll be particularly useful to people who work in the APRA-regulated industries. Please remember, we are running a competition. There is an iPad mini for the most thoughtful and the best question. That will be judged by the organising committee. So please send those through. Remember to say your name when you do ask a question, otherwise we won't know how to identify you. We don't want to identify you as, you know, the tall person with the big ears or something like that. It's now my pleasure to welcome David Murray to give the keynote address. David joined the Commonwealth Bank in 1966 and was appointed Chief Executive Officer in June 1992 and retired from that position in 2005. In November 2005, the Australian Government announced that Mr Murray would be Chairman of the Future Fund. His statutory term ended in April 2012. In November 2013, Mr Murray was appointed to head the Government's inquiry into Australia's financial system. The inquiry made recommendations to foster an efficient, competitive and flexible financial system consistent with financial stability, prudence, integrity and fair treatment. David is a member of the Oliver Wyman Senior Advisory Board and is a senior advisor to Credit Suisse. He has previously served as a member of the Finance Sector Advisory Council and was the inaugural chair of the International Forum of Sovereign Wealth Funds. He's also chair of the Butterfly Foundation dedicated to addressing eating disorders in Australia. In 2001, he was awarded the Centenary Medal for service to Australian society in banking and corporate governance, and in 2007 was made an officer in the Order of Australia. Please join me in welcoming David to the lectern.
Well, it's good to be here and support the Institute of Actuaries, a very important leading professional body in Australia, for whom we rely on considerable expertise in achieving what we do in business, in industry and government. Today I want to talk about banks and reputation, and I want to ask why it is that all of the very considerable work that banks put into their involvement with the community, that boards put into risk management, why that in the public arena and in the political arena has fallen to nothing, because their reputations, according to the media and according to political reporting, are not intact. And we need to do that, we need to understand whether the problem is about culture, whether it's about governance, whether it's about systemic law breaking, what is it about and what can be done. When I advised the government on the formation of the Future Fund, I was confronted with a problem that the Commonwealth government did not want the Future Fund to be involved in certain types of activities. Activities which collaborated with others in tax avoidance, activities that involved terrorism or anything else in global financing. And by the time we got to this, the bureaucrats had driven up a long list of things that the Future Fund could not be involved in, all of which we agreed. The problem was that addressing that list was too hard. And so we changed the mandate to say simply that the Future Fund couldn't act in a way that diminished the reputation of the Commonwealth government in international financial markets. Now, because we did that, we then had to work out internally how we were going to deal with reputation risk. The problem that I strike a lot now is people say, well, reputation risk is an outcome. But I believe you can do a lot to manage reputation risk from the start. The other thing that we did was to sit down as a board and formulate a set of investment beliefs. And this changed the way the organisation worked quite radically, and I'll explain that a little later. So the question today is, what can we do differently about this issue of reputation? Let me start with the problem itself, then how we might think about systems-based solution to reputation, and what we mean by board beliefs and how they can make a difference. So the starting problem for boards of banks is that under the corporations law in Australia, there are unrealistic and unfair treatment of directors, and this leads to a very defensive board culture. Those arrangements under the corporations law essentially in many respects treat directors like criminals before they start work. They have reversion of onus of proof on many of their activities. In areas such as sale of assets under the trade practices law, they do not have any due diligence defence. And so all of these arrangements in Australia make the starting position for boards and their directors very defensive, and a lot of good people will not join boards for this reason. The next we have is a one-size-fits-all corporate governance guidelines, which require companies, notwithstanding their competitive edge, the difference in their industry, the particular strengths they want to play off, what they all have the same system of corporate governance, the same board structures, the same committee structures, the same expected reporting arrangements for all of those things. And so this one-size-fits-all takes away difference and competitive edge. Next, the regulatory arrangements tend to move accountability from the executives to the board. APRA's requirement for the board to be accountable tends to take the accountability off the executive and move it to the board, yet the law has always been very clear that a director of a non-executive director cannot know everything. They are responsible, but they cannot know everything. And this also leads to direct relationships being formed between directors and individual executives, for example, the head of risk or whatever. And when I listen to directors, they tell me just how common it is for the chairman of the risk committee to spend a very extensive period of time with risk executives directly. This is not healthy for a normal operating board. And lastly, directors complain that for each meeting, whether it's a committee or a board meeting, they receive hundreds of pages of papers. Now, it is not possible to manage a company this or to lead a company this way or to govern it this way. If I were to get hundreds of pages of papers for a risk committee meeting, I would assume either that the workings of this committee are being invented for the first time and we've got a lot to get bedded down, or I would assume that something's gone horribly wrong in the organisation or the market and we've got a lot of work to do. So when we have 300 pages for one meeting and then a month later we have a fairly event-free meeting and then a month later there's another 300 pages, I assume something has gone horribly wrong, but usually it hasn't. This process of having this much paper, I exclude the half-yearly accounts and processes boards go through to report to their shareholders, that's complex. But this process of these papers, the size of papers, is about the executive delegating up to the board. And yet for some reasons, boards seem unable to deal with this. So boards have been drawn into management, compromising their abilities to supervise and hold the CEO accountable. So that's the nature of the problem that we confront. And the other side of that problem is that the world at large simply says, well, banks have got a culture problem. Now, if you do something wrong and the police take you down to court to charge you, they don't say you've got a culture problem. The magistrate might say in sentencing you, I know you've got a culture problem because this is the fifth time you've been here. You can't sort yourself out. But the starting point is they have to have a specific charge. And by saying that banks have a culture problem, we're avoiding a discussion about what is really the issue. And the reason I raise that is that whilst banks, as in all other industries, make mistakes, occasionally act in an unconscionable way with their customers, there we do not have in the banking industry today systemic law-breaking, as we've had in some other industries like the mafia and the bikies. So it seems very easy to get people wound up politically by saying that there's a culture problem. So let's look at culture and systems-based solutions. The culture of an organisation is the set of beliefs in that organisation, and it varies between businesses, countries, citizens, religions, all sorts of things. But it is the accumulated set of beliefs in an organisation. Those beliefs are derived from two things: the behaviour of the board and chief executive, and secondly, the systems that that company has in place to do its business. And those systems are both technical and human systems. And they are equally important in driving beliefs. So I think the behaviour of the executive is fairly obvious about belief sets. But let's talk about systems. Commonly banks' most complex area of work is IT. When the IT department changes all the systems and gives the new systems to the employees to work with the customers, through the chief executive they say, we've done this change, lot of hard work, cost a lot of money, now you have the best system in the world. Until somebody starts dealing with the system and looking at the screen and dealing with the customer and they find out it's not the best system in the world. And when people are confronted with something that doesn't work the way it should, they try their best to work around it. This is not because they're criminals. It's because they're people trying to do a good job. It's in the workaround process that the problems start. Most employees come to work, they do not they do not read the APRA Prudential Standards. They do not read the Corporations Law. They don't know the Trade Practices Act. Their executive is supposed to figure all this out. So it could be that when they work around things, they are doing their work on a basis that could be illegal and they don't know. It could be disreputable. It could be unauthorised in the organisation, particularly where the system of authorities is not clear. And it could, in fact, be unproductive rather than more productive. They think it's more productive to solve a problem one way, but it is, in fact, unproductive. In a great organisation, the executive spend a lot of time testing what's going on and rectifying all these things all the time. But they can't do that if they're not reading the beliefs of the people. In the human systems, which usually get much more attention, particularly the remuneration system in this area, problems arise where the HR processes are themselves not systematic and are not designed to avoid nepotism and run an organisation on merit. But there are crossovers. If, for example, people do not have confidence in the management accounting system, and the management accounting system is used as a basis for bonus pools based on contribution, based on profit, based on revenue, on whichever, then they will not have confidence in the remuneration system, and that will drive beliefs and behaviours in another direction. So the systems can cross over one another. The solution to this is to start at the board with their own set of beliefs, objectives for the organisation, an efficient governance system, and a process of appointment and supervision of the chief executive. The chief executive then has to form some strategic intent, has to undertake a change program because you can't compete if you're not changing all the time, and has to design and implement the technical and human systems under which that's done. So then, once those systems and those behaviours send the signals and establish the beliefs in the organisation, there should be a feedback system and a system of internal controls which ultimately builds in the organisation a system of shared beliefs which creates trust. Now, it's that trust which drives productivity improvement because people will collaborate to fix things and people will speak up if they don't like what's going on, if they trust one another. And that becomes the best risk mitigation. If that were done properly, we would not need whistleblowing provisions in legislation. But whistleblowing in a good organisation should be seen as a last resort. How do we then deal with this issue of beliefs in relation to the banking world? If a board does not have its own beliefs about their bank and banking, it's hard to see how they're going to approach the appointment of a new CEO, regarded generally as the most important decision that any board makes. If they don't know, if they don't have a set of shared beliefs, and they don't know whether an incoming CEO shares those beliefs or not with them, there's a lot of things that they could miss. And we've seen some of them around the world. The CEO believes that the only successful path to growth in banks is by takeover. We saw some magnificent examples of how that went wrong in the lead-up to the crisis. CEOs who don't understand agency issues, employment in banks as distinct from other industries. So the starting point is without their own set of beliefs, it gets difficult. The set of beliefs they have also helps them to guide policy formulation and delegation of authority, which takes away the 300 pages of work. And it's possible in banks today to see firstly, risk committees that don't have reputation risk on their agenda, and audit committees that don't spend enough time on the system of internal control, and the gaps in the floorboards between those two are considerable. And this leaves directors of banks governing by waiting for the next mistake. No wonder the number of pages keeps rising. This is not how you can govern anything successfully. So in banking, there are five issues that, as a minimum, need to be considered in a set of beliefs. And a lot of these are the same things that drive the need for regulation in banks. One is tendency to monopoly, and this is common in all industry, same in banks, needs to be understood, and it should be recognised by boards. It is a valid reason for regulation, and there's no point trying to evade it. The second is what we call externalities that are caused by momentum in markets, or put another way, self-amplifying market spirals. And we saw this in the lead-up to the crisis. These self-amplifying market spirals tend to spread risk from the shareholders of banks to society. And it means that the losses that result from these when the market corrects are not necessarily borne only by shareholders. And this gives rise to moral hazard and the involvement in government in rescues. The third is what we call information asymmetry, the knowledge gap between buyer and seller. And it's in this area that the Financial System Inquiry made a significant leap, where we decided that product disclosures weren't of themselves enough and more had to be done to close that gap or regulate that gap in favour of the consumer. The fourth issue, common to most industries, is agency risk. And it's not just about remuneration, but typically we go there. A board should ask why the chief executive of a bank should be remunerated any more than an industrial company of like complexity. It should ask itself why it's happened that the remuneration of bank chief executives is correlated positive. I've got to be careful with the actuaries when you say these words. Correlated positively with market cap. And when you put that together with this issue of self-amplifying market signals and momentum in markets that lead to crashes, what's actually going on, the dynamic between remuneration for size and systemic failure later. And the common agency risk is that there are different parts of a banking organisation working in different markets. The markets groups, the institutional banking groups, the wealth management groups, the retail banking people and so on, where the remuneration structures are different. Now, people can accommodate that if they can see why, but where it is not clear why and where the bonus systems don't appear to be properly applied, then the idea of trust and collaboration is lost. The fifth area is that of portfolio management. One of my directors who'd been on the board only a short time, once said to me, look, I was a bit scared to ask the chairman this, but how come in the whole 6 months I've been here so far, we never make any decisions? Now, I felt like saying, because you're on the board, don't worry about that, we worry about that for you. But that wouldn't have worked. So I said, the issue is that we're not like an industrial company. We don't make a very big and risky decision on a major construction of plant and capacity expansion or 100 new stores in a retailer or whatever you might do in industry. We don't do that. And he said, well, where's all the assets? And I said, well, most of them are called loan contracts. What you're managing is a portfolio of risk. And that is a very different governance challenge from the sort of challenge you might have in an industrial company. So unless bank board beliefs go to portfolio theory, which is also needs to be considered in the context of asset liability management, then it is increasingly difficult for them to understand whether they've got a CEO that actually understands it. So the solution to the issue is firstly that bank boards need to go to their own set of beliefs, and by sharing them and understanding well, they can govern quite differently. Second, using those beliefs, they should redefine their governance systems, relationship with the CEO, and their own education and development programs. And what, having done that, they can then institute a set of policy reviews which take each major area of policy, for example, credit policy, and within those reviews understand the delegations and the exceptions reporting that is necessary for the board to operate. Once they go to exceptions reporting from well-formulated policy and clear delegations, the number of papers will reduce significantly, and more importantly, the board will feel far more comfortable about the governance of the organisation itself. So by doing that, they can make a big difference, but if we keep jumping up and down about culture publicly, it won't make any difference. And it should be clear, though, from what the problems that are worrying these directors, that the banks themselves have to do an awful lot internally to get out of a position where every small mistake is amplified into a call for a Royal Commission in Canberra. Thank you.
Thank you, David. I think there's probably a lot of directors who would appreciate our smaller sets of board papers. We are running a little bit behind schedule, but we will try and stick to our allocated time for Q&A. I'm sure there's lots of people, I know the media are in the room, if people have some questions. So just a reminder to please state your name and which organisation you're from. Just to clarify, just so that there's no disputes later on in terms of the free iPad, the question must be asked by someone who's physically here, so the people on the webinar, I apologise, you're ineligible. And just a reminder, the winner cannot be a speaker, a chair from the organising committee or a member of institute staff. Okay, now over to questions. Yes. And so just to repeat, please wait for the microphone to come.
My name's Neil Allen from Systemic Consultant. I have both an observation and a, well, perhaps an observation and a question as a result. I think the public and the media see behaviours and not beliefs. And so it's not an obvious connection for me that there's a shared belief in what those behaviours actually become, because I believe I don't drink too much, but maybe my wife observing me would see that maybe I do. And so how does the board think about that gap between what's the behaviours and the beliefs?
What the executive in particular should be doing all the time is looking for beliefs, behaviours in the organisation that come from beliefs that are not aligned with the way the organisation is meant to work. And this is not beliefs about their individual religion or their own ethnic culture or any. In fact, organisations should stay right out of that. So they're looking for behaviours that indicate beliefs that are out of line with where they should be. And I can remember seeing lots of them. If that signals people doing unauthorised and unproductive work, there's huge value in the organisation authorising it and making it productive. So it's a positive process. And the thing that's commonly missing where things are done incorrectly and they shouldn't be is a really strong internal control system. And it tends to get lack of attention in the modern risk management approach at the board.
Thank you.
Any other questions at the back?
Hi, David. It's James Ayres from the Financial Review. I just wondered if you might be able to comment on the process that the Australian Bankers Association are going through at the moment with respect to reviewing their remuneration in banks, the code of conduct, the complaints mechanisms, which were all announced the day after the federal government got up and said that it would respond to your inquiries, calls for ASIC to have more powers and industry funding. And the reason I'm asking is your report sort of made a number of suggestions about how culture may be able to be improved. The government said it would act upon those, yet the industry seemed as though it felt it was necessary to do more. I wondered if you thought that perhaps your report didn't go far enough in its recommendations on culture and perhaps on remuneration, and that sort of left a bit of a gap that needed to be filled by these own by the industry's own initiatives, and whether or not you think they're going to make any difference.
Well, we're very clear that culture is not something you can regulate for. So it's up to each. It's up to the industry and each institution in the industry to sort out behaviours in their organisation that diverge from what they expect, and particularly when they diverge from good, legal behaviour. So it is up to them. And the reason we said that in our report was that we believed very strongly that you should not politicise the banking system. And it's a very dangerous thing to do, to have banks run by the political process. It's why we have an independent APRA, an independent central bank with monetary policy. And it ultimately leads to a breakdown in the credit creation process. And in the process of our inquiry and our public hearings, we got a very substantial set of submissions and arguments about abandoning credit creation in privately owned banks and going back to a system where the government does all the credit creation. Not a very happy proposal, I don't think, but this is one reason why I think the banks are doing what they're doing now, because the problem with a Royal Commission is the outcome would be completely uncertain.
Questions? Oh, sorry, John.
David, John Kavanagh from Banking Day. If we just take the example of the Commonwealth Bank, they've had to recently refund fees that were miscalculated. They've been in trouble for an extensive period over their financial planning, and earlier this year there was a problem with claims on insurance policies, and they're waiting to be sued by ASIC over BBSW manipulation. How is that not systemic law breaking?
I think in I've had letters from my gas supplier which have clearly been drafted by their regulator. This happens a lot. The question is it happening repeatedly and intentionally? By repeatedly, I mean all the time. There have been episodes which have been on the back of different events. And it's up to the Commonwealth Bank to figure out how quickly they solve them and how quickly they rebuild trust when they occur. The issue, though, as we've seen in the UK, where there can be imposed solutions, is that people will arbitrage them. It became possible in the UK for people to know that the banks had drawn a line at a certain number, and if you rang up fast enough, you could get the money whether you were involved or not. So the banks have a right to a rule of law as well, and they have to solve these problems. But some of the regulation that we recommended has not yet been implemented, and when it is implemented, it should make a difference.
One of the things you often hear, Ross Greenwood from Channel 9, one of the things you often hear when there are incidents inside banks or other organisations is that it was a result of a rogue or a lone wolf. Now, this seems to be almost an habitual thing that an organisation comes out when there's an incident. This is a one-off. It's a lone wolf. It's a rogue. How does an organisation culturally manage the lone wolves and the rogues inside their organisation. Because if you are to try and put mechanisms in place culturally, then you would hope that really the colleagues around them would have identified the lone wolf and had them out the door earlier. But it doesn't seem to happen.
In my experience, there are two ways. One, if you build that culture correctly, somebody will speak up. And the second is that if you build the human system, a human system which eliminates nepotism, then people will be able to speak up. Because if advancement in the organisation is based on power, people will align themselves with others and not speak up. And that's one of the hardest things to build. But in conjunction with that, when we did talent reviews, we assessed both capacity to do work at a certain level of complexity and behaviours. And some of the lone wolves that you mention often are people who are exceptionally intelligent. They can read and interpret all of the complex policy documents in an organisation very quickly, and they know how to work around them very quickly. And if you combine that with a remuneration system with bonus pools and so on, people can build them in their own interest. And this is why boards need to study agency issues as part of their beliefs. And so in certain areas, we imposed limits on aggregate activity, not because we necessarily didn't want to have the activity, but we imposed the limits as a point at which the executive and the board might discuss why this is growing so quickly.
Probably got time for one more. I'm just down the front here.
Hi, I'm Shiminta Jani from Macquarie Bank. I was interested in what you thought was the value of advertising in shaping the public perception. We see banks that are helping small businesses and winching people out of danger, and whether you think that that's helping to change the public perception of the bank's value in the community.
Look, I think they have to do something about it because it's a one-way communication system at the moment, and they have to do something. The difficulty is what to do and how to go about it. And it's interesting, having not been in a bank for a long time now, when I watch their advertisements, I can see the one that's been put there because the bank's had a recent problem, or the advertising agency's not getting very clear direction on how their products work and what they should advertise, so they do one of those general ones, you know. Makes the bank look very sweet. And but I think the industry needs something more substantive to try and explain how banks add value to an economy and why they need to be managed with care, because they're highly leveraged institutions. Now, the best minds in advertising and creative can get that across if they get the right brief.
Okay, I might need to close it there because we are over time, but I'd like to thank David for coming and giving a keynote address and providing some very useful insights on culture and governance, which I think will inform a lot of our discussion through the remainder of the day. So please join me in thanking David.